This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
A Canadian sociologist says terrorist groups are using recruitment methods that are very similar to the behavior of religious cults. Lorne Dawson is a professor at the University of Waterloo and co-director of the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security and Society. Professor Dawson has appeared at a recent Canadian Senate hearing urging the Conservative government to renew funding for independent research into counterterrorism.
I spoke with Lorne Dawson earlier this week, and here's that interview.
How are cults or new religious movements similar to terrorist groups?
Well, it's a pretty broad question, but it really comes down to noticing that the nature of the people that are drawn to these organizations turns out to be very similar. I strongly suspect, and the evidence seems to support, that the process by which people become involved is very similar. Scholars for some time, terrorism scholars, have talked about it as being like a conversion process, the process of radicalization, and some of them have directly pointed to studies of conversion, the case of new religious movements. And then some of the dynamic that promotes violence within these groups is very similar as well. So sort of looking at those elements, the similarity in terms of background is that contrary to sort of popular stereotypes, whether you're dealing with new religious movements or with young people who radicalize, it's not actually people on the whole, there's always variation, but it's not on the whole marginalized young individuals, confused or weak individuals who are being preyed upon by, crafty cult leaders or terrorist recruiters of some sort. The record of evidence actually suggests that largely we're talking about young people who are coming from pretty conventional middle-class homes. They're coming from reasonably privileged backgrounds. They have reasonably good educational levels. Often they have even quite high educational levels. They are don't come from homes that have any more dysfunction than the average home. The individuals in both cases don't have any more elements of mental health or psychiatric issues than is present in the population as a whole. They're very what the New York City Police Department, referring to those who are radicalized, said they're remarkably ordinary. And that's true for most people who join new religious movements too. But when you press closer, the similarity that comes out is that it always goes into adolescent identity struggles. And certain individuals that are having a particularly hard time adjusting to adult life. Now, what the situation is, and we don't have full evidence for this for terrorists, people who join terrorism yet, but the evidence is pointing in the same direction as for those who join new religious movements, is that you actually have good kids. You have kids who have really taken to heart through socialization the values and norms of their society or their ethnic group or their religious community. And as they approach adolescence, they start to become very upset and discouraged because the world appears to be full of more hypocrisy and apathy and outright corruption than they thought would be the case. And they get literally morally angry and frustrated by this. They also are trying to find out how they themselves can have an important and significant role in the world. And they don't dislike their parents, so they don't want to engage in open acts of rebellion against their parents, but they do want to break away from their parents because they see their parents as being somewhat apathetic. So it gets them into a deep turmoil. And in both cases, what happens is this is a time of what's called cognitive opening. And it's at this moment that along comes either the cult message or in this case, the jihadi terrorist message that provides a neat, clean, moral kind of narrative about who's good, who's bad, why the world the way it is the way it is, what can be done about it, and what you're individually, what you as an individual, the role you can play, a heroic role you can play in saving the world from itself. And for these young people, that clarity of that message, the call to a greater purpose, has tremendous resonance. And in the case of new religious movements, we know that 90% of the people who feel the call to join a group, if they're left alone, on their own in less than 2 years, they will leave the new religious movement, which leads us to believe that it is this sort of identity struggle that's at issue. And once it's resolved, then they don't need the organization anymore. Now, of course, as terrorists, we don't have the opportunity too often to see someone come in and go out the other side, though there is some evidence of that. Because, regrettably, they either die or they get involved in criminal activity that's going to have consequences for them in terms of long prison terms or things of that nature. The second feature that I mentioned was the process of joining is very similar. So I've alluded to that already, but the key feature is that when people are involved in this struggle, it's finding other individuals of like mind. So the small group dynamics are absolutely crucial. And if a person goes through this struggle and really doesn't find anyone else of a, you know, experiencing things in a similar manner, then the odds are things will be resolved in some more, you know, straightforward way. But more often than not, you start seeking and you find other people of like, other young people drawn to similar ideas and being pushed by similar kinds of concerns. And then you get small group dynamics in terms of the social psychology, the peer pressure of the groups. Very standard measures of social psychology can come into play here so that, for example, there's something called shift to risk, where if you take a group of young people and you ask them to do some risky endeavor and you interview them, they'll be disinclined to do it because it's just too dangerous or it scares them in some manner. But if you put them into a group and you plant someone who's very enthusiastic about the task, the majority of the group will all of a sudden become very excited about undertaking that risky measure. If you interview them later, they will then express their doubts again. But that's separate from the group. When they're with the group, they'll always be very enthusiastic. There's this tremendous need to bond, to be conformed to the group, and to be willing to show to the others that you're willing to stand up to the challenge. Now, we see lots of evidence of that taking place in both the early stages of people joining new religious movements, and also in the young guys who are sitting around watching jihadi videos together, whether they're videos of young Palestinians being injured by Israeli defense forces, or they're videos of beheadings, and they're cheering each other on in their enthusiasm for the cause. And then they start a kind of outbidding process. Someone finally says, I'm going to go fight, or I'm going to start plotting to do something. And it becomes a challenge for the others to be able to say no and back off from the crowd. A few individuals will, but most will actually get drawn into sort of the vortex of the risky behavior.
The North American media narrative about ISIS, for example, particularly, is that their use of social media, and you mentioned videos, is very or extremely sophisticated. Is this an exaggeration? Is it kind of a side issue to the broader dynamic that you're talking about?
The answer is sort of yes and no. I mean, it is being exaggerated in the media, and a point I always make based on research, and it's been confirmed by some studies in terms of terrorist use of the Internet as well. But larger research on the Internet and recruitment processes through the Internet confirm that the Internet on its own is not enough. A virtual presence is not enough. It has to be complemented with some kind of face-to-face interaction, especially interaction with someone who's kind of a mentor or a charismatic figure or someone that it can exert some more direct personal appeal to someone. Having said that, however, we are living in a media-saturated age, and especially young people are, and they definitely acquire all their information online, and they can be interacting with individuals of like mind online and come pretty close to that face-to-face or personal interaction in terms of chat forums and things of that nature. Now, Al-Qaeda has always known the value of communications and dedicated considerable amount of time and effort, especially a group like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that produces the Inspire magazine, a very sophisticated glossy magazine made available through the Internet. But groups like ISIS have ratcheted this up tremendously. They have about 40, 50 people dedicated to nothing but media activity on a full-time basis. The videos they're releasing are not amazing in terms of, you know, professional Western standards per se, but relative to what other kind of videos and materials that other groups have been able to produce over the years, they are quite remarkable. They're in high definition. They're well edited. They're long. They have a storyline. They involve interesting use of backgrounds. They use music effectively. So they are a step up from anything we've seen before. Now, what they're complementing the videos with, which is the key, is the use of social media, of using Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, Kick Messenger, all of these devices. And recently the New York Times reported that ISIS is probably issuing something on the order of 90,000 social media messages a day. So what they're doing is they're literally using all of their foot soldiers, so to speak, are in pretty regular contact with people outside of Syria and Iraq using Twitter. So our research group, we're studying Canadian foreign fighters right now. For months and months, we've been in direct contact with all kinds of individuals in Syria and Iraq, and there's a steady stream of interaction with them, and it's very fascinating, and it would be even more fascinating to a young person to see the day-to-day activity of these fighters, what is happening in their lives, because they are revealing day-to-day what is going on in their lives, interspersed with calls for support and to come join the cause. So there is a steady stream of information, higher quality information, and now increasingly more this personal touch or contact is happening through the media as well.
What kinds of intervention can occur for people who are being recruited by or attracted to joining a terrorist group or cult?
We're still in the sort of very infant stages of understanding how to effectively intervene with people who may be radicalizing. There are a handful of countering violent extremism programs operating in the world. There's one in Germany that's based on a model from Norway and Sweden. There's a one operating in Great Britain. There's a private one operating in the United States. Canada has the nascent sort of the RCMP is beginning to put together a program. There are a few others. We're getting a little bit of data and information from them. And there's some grassroots attempt happening everywhere, Australia, Canada, England, you name it, but they haven't really been studied. I've been able to be present at some workshops where a handful of the people who founded these programs and are running these programs have been able to talk about what they're doing and how they're designing it and some sense of the results. And the one sort of feature that's coming out pretty clearly is that you have to get at young people very early in the process, that if you're trying to intervene by the point that someone has already resolved that they're going to be going to Syria, let's say if it's a foreign fighter, or they're intent on taking some action, it's too late. Usually your intervention at that point will just put their backs up and solidify their radicalization, solidify their intent. You'll be seen as a hostile intervening force that is proving to them that they're doing something worthwhile, and hence you're trying to stop them. So you've got to get early enough on when people are still in that identity struggle stage, and they're just sampling the new message, they're sampling the new identity. Again, if I go to new religious movement literature, we have ample evidence there that people try on behaviors first. They role play at being a convert to some new set of beliefs, significantly before they start to change their attitudes and really fundamentally change their beliefs. You've got to get in there when they're just role-playing, when they are just experimenting with these views. They're still open at that point to recognizing the tremendous costs of what they're about to do, that maybe the message they're receiving isn't the whole truth, right, or a fully or accurate picture of what they're about to become engaged with. And to actually talk to them about things like the costs that it'll have in terms of their parents and their families and things of that nature. For young men from a Muslim background and women from a Muslim background, some of these organizations have reported that if you get in early enough, they still do care what their parents think. And so that can be an effective means of putting pressure on them.
Professor Lorne Dawson, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
No, I was very pleased to help. Hope your listeners get some benefit from this.
Lorne Dawson is a professor at the University of Waterloo and co-director of the Canadian Network for Research on Terrorism, Security and Society. You can find out more online at tsas.ca.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.